Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and welcome to another Recovery Radio broadcast recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latah Recovery Center located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all, and to share the recovery resources available in our area, along with the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continuing recovery. And today in the studio slash conference room with me is Daryl Keim. And Daryl is the director of the Latah Recovery Center and our trusted servant. Daryl, welcome. Glad to have you here today.
Yep, I'm happy to be here today. Thanks, Johnny.
Glad to have you with us. We've chatted with you before and talked about things that are going on at the Recovery Center, but I'd like to go a little deep into your bio, a little bit of your background, how you wound up in Moscow, Idaho, education, work experience. Pretend this is an interview for a job you already have.
An interview for a job I already have. I think I've done that before. I think that's how I got this job, in fact. After I started the place, they then interviewed me to see if they wanted to hire me. Did you know that?
No, but
and I almost didn't get the job.
I can believe that. I mean, that's terrible. I'm glad you did.
Well, I had some excellent competition. I might not have hired me knowing who I was competing against, too. But yeah, I had to interview for the job I was already doing. It was pretty fun. So you want to know about me, huh? What do you want to know?
Well, let's start out with the early part. I know you're originally a Montana native. Why don't we go from there?
Actually, I'm a Missouri native.
Oh, Missouri.
But I did go to some elementary, junior high, and high school, and college in Montana, in various towns in Montana. So, yep, that's as close to being a native as you could be without quite being a native.
Right, right.
So I went to, I guess I'll start in college. I went to Carroll College, which is a small liberal arts Catholic school in Helena, Montana. Got a degree there in communications and met my future wife there. And that's actually how I ended up in the Moscow Pullman area. She was a couple years older than me. She decided to get a master's degree over at WSU. And I suddenly decided that it'd be a good idea to pursue a master's degree at WSU.
Yeah, it's that would seem to work out.
It did work out.
As long as you're in the neighborhood, right?
Yeah, it worked out very, very well. So she came over in 92, I came over in 94, and we've been here ever since. We both got master's degrees from the Murrow School of Communications, now the Murrow College of Communication.
Right. Yes.
And got jobs out of school. Always thought we'd leave town as soon as we graduated, but we had decent jobs when we graduated. So we just, we moved out of town from Pullman to Moscow. And we've been here ever since.
Cool-a-roo. You've been kind of a sucker for nonprofits for a long time. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your work history here and there?
So my very first job right out of school with my sparkly new master's degree, I got hired to run the thrift store for Sojourners Alliance. And I kind of considered that to be a paid internship more than anything with the amount I was getting paid versus my master's degree. But I wanted to do it because it gave me the chance to be 100% in charge. I got to decide everything. I got to work with the volunteers. I got to decide advertising and all the stuff that you do when you run a small store. Did that for a little over a year. Really enjoyed working with Sojourners Alliance, which is a habit I kind of formed then and have been off their board and on their board over the years and currently am on it ever since then. So that was around 1996 to 97 or so. Then WSU came calling back to me and they said, how would you like to be a staff development trainer with leadership development skills and communication skills and a few other things that they offered at that time as live training for their staff? So they hired me, worked there for a few years. Can't say that I loved it, can't say I hated it, but another job came along that I'd always wanted to do. When I was younger, I was a Boy Scout, pursued and got my Eagle Scout, had a wonderful experience, very formative to me. And I saw that there was an opening for what's called a Boy Scouts of America District Executive locally. I had no clue what that was, so I did it.
Good way to figure out what something
is. That was a good way to figure out what
something
is.
Diving in and going, all right, I'll take the job. Now what do I do?
Yeah, so I worked for them. It was a remote job in the so long before everybody else had portable jobs like we do now. I worked out of my house for 10 years, which really spoils you.
Oh, I can only, yeah, having been self-employed and working from home, going back into that 9-to-5 tie-wearing universe was a little unnerving.
Exactly. So I did that, and that's where I learned my skills working for a nonprofit, because really what a Boy Scout troop is on the leadership side is it's a tiny little nonprofit. It's got a board of directors like a nonprofit does. It has to fundraise. It has to recruit. It has to train, all of that. So I was responsible. It started out, I was responsible for all of the scouting in Latah and Whitman counties, which to give you a little idea of what that was at the time, that was about 1,300 youth, and that was about 65 different scouting groups in the area. So to really define that for you, the Boy Scouts always have the goal, at least back then, had the goal of trying to have a Cub Scout pack associated with every elementary school in the area.
Right. I remember that from when I was young. Yeah,
exactly. And trying to have a Boy Scout troop that's associated with every Cub Scout pack. We pretty much had that in this area at that time. Or at least we did by the time I was done. So I managed all that. And big picture, it meant that I managed about 600 volunteers, providing a program for 1,200 youth. And then over time, success is rewarded with more work. So I got...
No good deed goes unpunished.
I got promoted to also cover the Lewiston-Clarkston area. And essentially by the time I stepped back from that job in 2008, I think it was, I was covering everything from Roselia down to Whitebird and from the Montana border over into Washington, into, like I said, Whitman County.
Wow.
So I had a service area that was bigger than most eastern states.
Yeah. It was fun. I was going to say, that's a lot of squares.
It was a very fun job. Though, you know, whenever people hear you're a professional Boy Scout, they think, oh, you must have gone camping with the kids and had all kinds of fun playing games. No, not at all. It was my job to recruit the volunteers to do that.
Right.
And if I was having fun with the kids, it's because I had failed in recruiting volunteers to do that.
Right. Sure, sure.
And I kind of take that mentality up through today, too, in that the volunteers should be the front-facing folks that get to see the impact of the program and get to feel the impact of the program while I'm the support in the background, making sure that they succeed.
Right. Absolutely. Now, you know, a question I always have, you mentioned fundraising. It doesn't sound like you were terribly involved in that, but were you?
Because
it kind of relates where we're going down the road.
So from the standpoint of a professional Boy Scout, and the non-professional scouts aren't like this at all, but my job was essentially sales. I had to meet very numerical, very specific goals in money, manpower, and membership every year. And my job was on the line if I didn't. So it was very much a sales job. I had to always be showing improvement in the number of youth we had in the program, improvement in the number of packs and troops we had in the program, and improvement in the financial aspects of things too. So to give you a clue, if I recall correctly, the year I started, I ran what was called a Friends of Scouting campaign, which means I asked for donations.
Right.
And my goal was $27,000. And we sold popcorn, most expensive popcorn in the world, I swear. I don't recall what the goal was, but I think it was around that same ballpark. And that was my financial goals for the year. By the time I resigned, I think it was approximately 9 or 10 years later, we were raising, I think my friend's scouting goal was $60,000, so I doubled it over time. And my popcorn goal was $100,000 worth of popcorn, which I can tell you, Johnny, if you've never seen $100,000 worth of popcorn.
That's a lot of popcorn.
That's a lot of popcorn. And it was really funny because we would distribute it in two chunks. One chunk would go to City North American Van Lines, the biggest chunk. And that'd be like $50,000 worth of popcorn. So many, many pallets of popcorn. And then they would have another part of the sale because it was a two-part sale. And we wouldn't bother saying North American because it wasn't so much popcorn. It was more like $20,000 worth of popcorn. That would sit in my garage overnight.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always prayed that nobody knew. Right. There was $20,000 worth of product sitting in my garage that night. It was always kind of a nervous night. Yeah, they gave me my first experience really with fundraising, which has proven fairly important to my later work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So worked for them for, like I say, 9 or maybe 10 years. And ultimately, I ended up resigning from that because we had young kids and I had to be gone 4 nights out of the week, mm-hmm. 9 months out of the year. And one day my daughter looked at me and said, I've got this event going tomorrow, next week, Dad, but I know you can't make it.
Oh, man.
And that was exactly what I said. And pretty much the look you just gave me was the look I had, too. Yeah. Took me about a year to figure out an alternative at that point. But she was maybe 3, and she'd figured out that I couldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't who I wanted to be.
Right.
So that's not who I let myself be. So next move after that, like I say, it took me about a year. I got hired on by the Moscow Chamber of Commerce. Long story short, I didn't feel it was a great fit. Did it for about a year. And then I got hired on, and I chose to quit, I should say. I chose to quit 2 weeks before the Lehman Brothers went out of business in 2009, if you remember that.
Right, right.
That was the start of the major banking crisis, and right. 2 weeks after that, they had hiring freezes throughout for all jobs,
because the economy just hit the crapper.
I quit with spectacularly poor timing. I did not have another job lined up, but somebody was looking out for me because very short order, I found a temporary job working for the University of Idaho Conferences and Institutes program. And I was hired for one reason and one reason only, and I knew it was only going to be about a 9-month appointment, and it was awesome. And I had the full support of the university for anything I needed to do because it was a university-wide, very all-eyes-are-on-us deal. They were bringing the three major scientific societies that study evolution together for a worldwide conference here in Moscow. And I was to be staff support for that. So I got to bring 1,200 evolutionary biologists into town, handle all the staff support aspects of that. While they had a professor, they handled all the educational and professorial sides of that. I worked with him.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. And I never would have thought it, but boy, those guys can get really passionate. There was even a bar fight over evolutionary theory.
Oh, that must have been spectacular.
I'm told it was.
Another reason I quit drinking too soon.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun. True story. Got the bomb squad called on us, which was hilarious.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there one day at the staff booth, and a guy comes up to me. And he's one of the evolutionary biologists. And he walks up and he says, I wonder if I could get a change of room. And I said, well, tell me a little bit more about why. He said to me, well, I knew I was staying in dorms and they weren't going to be all that great. And I'm fine with that. But I found an M80 in my closet. And for those of you guys that don't know what an M80 is, that's a fun little firework that's roughly a quarter stick of dynamite.
Right.
And I didn't think much of that. So I said, sure, we'll get you another room, you know, and we just switched the room. And then I called up housekeeping and I said, hey, housekeeping, prep this room and clean this other room. And they asked why he was moving out too. And I said the same thing. I said, well, you found an M80. And they said, well, what's an M80? And I said, well, it's a quarter stick of dynamite. And they went, it's a what? And that should have been my clue that I was about to have some trouble. So I said, yeah, it's a quarter stick of dynamite. Can you clean it out? And they said, sure. Maybe half an hour later, I get a call from somebody saying, why are the police here? So housekeeping didn't like the idea of cleaning up a quarter stick of dynamite.
That's a reasonable...
They brought in the police, which then brought in our whole security protocol for the campus.
Right.
So from me saying, sure, you can have a new building, a new place to stay, and finding out why... It ended up that the head of security was called, the police were called, the police responded, the president was called, my boss was called, which is the worst thing of all, of course.
Right.
And it went all the way up and down the security chain because of a quarter stick of dynamite.
Right.
So my boss calls me like, why was the president called? And I said, well, I've got good news and bad news, Rob. He's like, what's the good news? The good news is it's really nothing, Rob. What's the bad news? Bad news is that the president got called, Rob. And all that over a quarter stick of dynamite. Had I known, lesson learned here for you.
Right.
Lesson learned is, had I known, I simply would have gone and retrieved the M80 myself and had some fun later this summer. But yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a fun job. I got plenty more stories, but the purpose of this isn't for me to tell all my fun stories. So I did that.
Or it is.
I did that job, and the conference went very well. What can I say?
Mm-hmm.
And then, as promised, I found myself looking for work roughly 9 months later, and I landed at the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, where I was a community resource development specialist, which is a really fancy title that doesn't tell you a thing about what I did. I worked for them for several years, I think it was 5 or 6, and as a community resource development specialist, it was my job to be familiar with all the communities in North Central Idaho, Region 2, mm-hmm. Health and Welfare Department. And so that meant basically everything from Potlatch down to Whitebird. Yep. So basically the same territory I'd had with the Boy Scouts, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to know all of the resources that were health and welfare might want to be able to tap into.
Right.
Encourage them to grow. And then occasionally they would say, hey, we want you to develop such and such a resource. And that's how we ended up with the Recovery Community Center. Was they contacted me in about 2013, 2 years before we started, and they told me two very important things. Number one, they wanted me to take the time and try and develop a recovery community center and pursue a grant that they had their eyes on for somewhere in North Central Idaho. And they were going to develop some more of these. They were going to develop 4 throughout the state at that point. And the other crucial thing that they told me was, and by the way, in 2 years, your job's going to be eliminated statewide. So I suddenly decided that Moscow, Idaho was a great place to try and locate a recovery community center. And that's how I got here.
Well, it, in your defense, we are the county seat. We are the most populous city in the county. So,
and it was a logical choice.
Slightly selfish.
it was a perfectly logical choice. When I looked at it, it came down to 3 communities that I was going to look at. Moscow, obviously, because mm-hmm. I was familiar with Moscow. And Moscow had a strong recovery community and was well known for supporting its stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Lewiston, because it's a bigger population with a very big need for recovery-oriented stuff.
Right.
And then Orofino, we also looked at because it's got the state hospital there and lots of supports. And it's a smaller town, obviously, but there would have been a lot of community support for it. Orofino didn't stay on my list very long. Lewiston and Moscow were neck and neck for a long time. But ultimately, the recovery community and the mental health recovery community in particular were stronger in Moscow. And I knew some of the people and we were able to make a quicker go of it. But ultimately, I did end up helping to start a Lewiston Recovery Center, too.
Good.
So cool. I did have my hands involved in both, but the Moscow one took off a year earlier than the Lewiston one.
And that
brings you up to date.
Brings you up to 2005 and
2015.
2015, excuse me.
Yeah.
Got that right. Hey, you know what? I'm going to have us take a little break right here, let you cough a couple of times.
That's a good idea.
We'll come back and launch into the present.
Yeah, the present,
and we'll go from there. All right, everybody, you're listening to KRFP 90.3 in beautiful Moscow Pullman, and we'll be right back.
Down on me.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3, the coolest station in the nation. At least that's my opinion. I'm sticking to it.
They must have a good air conditioner, huh?
We do. Also, in the studio / conference room with me today is Daryl Keim, the director of the Latah Recovery Community Center. And Daryl's been filling us in a little bit on his history, and we're up to 2015, where I believe is the beginning of the Latah Recovery Center. So throw it back to you, Daryl, and kicking off 2015 with the opening of, well, let's go into what it took to open, because that's a story too.
What it took to open. So that would have started around 2014, probably early 2014, late 2013. And it all started, Idaho Association of Counties had a meeting up here. At least this is when it started up here. A woman by the name of Roseanne DeWeza was there. And she was talking about a trip that they had taken, they being some members from the Idaho Association of Counties, and approximately 25 people from Idaho had gone over to check out Connecticut and see what they were doing with their recovery community center concept in Connecticut. The group that you'll sometimes, if you've heard me talk in the past, you've heard me talk about CCAR, Connecticut Communities for Addiction Recovery. So she was coming, and she came to IAC in Moscow. I was there and talked about this group, about what they were doing and how she would love to see this recovery community center concept started in Idaho. And somebody, I don't recall who, might have even been Rosie, said, well, have you guys considered talking to the Idaho State Millennium Fund to see if they would fund this as a startup? And that's where the idea came for how they ultimately funded the recovery centers, and they still help fund us via the Millennium Fund. For those of you guys that don't know, the Millennium Fund is a fund that the legislature has that was started in 1999-2000 off of the big tobacco settlements for all the false advertising and everything that they'd done. So billions of dollars every year that's set aside as an investment fund. And one of the things that the legislature back in 1999-2000 did is they set that money aside for anti-smoking and anti-addiction efforts. So, and they were funding for various campaigns, and they funded each one of the initial four recovery community centers. I think they set aside $500,000 that year for the entire effort. So mm-hmm. for them, you know, decimal dust, but it got us going.
Right, decimal dust. Love it. Yes.
Yeah. So that got us started, and then from there, that was when I got the nudge from my boss that they wanted us to try and start something in North Central Idaho. They wanted to have something in each part of Idaho. So they wanted something in North Central Idaho. They wanted something, of course, they wanted something in Boise. They wanted something in Southwest Idaho, Southeast Idaho. I forget the four locations. And we had to essentially write a grant application, put together a business plan, and apply to see whether we would get funded. And we were one of the winners.
Cool.
Yeah, so I put together a committee that, 7 or 8 people. I was the chair of it at the time. And we met every week religiously about what this would look like, writing the business plan and envisioning what we could do with it and making it a go. And then we sat back and waited nervously to see if our proposal was funded. And it was, to the tune of, I think it was $125,000.
Cool.
One-time funding. So no guarantees we'd continue to get funded after that, with the idea we would set up shop and then go from there.
So it was decided on, you wanted to have the recovery center in downtown, and you had to somehow convince the NIMBYs, which are not in my backyard folks, that this was going to be a good idea, mm-hmm. and we would be good neighbors, et mm-hmm. cetera.
Yeah. We didn't initially know that we'd be able to put it on Main Street. We looked at different locations. We had a committee that looked at probably 30 different locations. Most of them, you know, we just quickly drove by and were like, oh, we don't like that, or for this reason, it might be the basement or something. Because we knew we wanted to be, as following the model we were asked to follow, we knew we wanted to be out and as public as possible to make recovery into something that's that's not a basement type thing, not something to be ashamed of,
right?
But is simply the medical issue that it is. So we knew we wanted to be out and have signs and not be anonymous in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know that we'd be able to find something downtown. So we looked all around town, like I say, about 30 different locations. And I'd say a third of them we couldn't do due to some sort of NIMBY. You know, the landlord didn't want to talk to us when they heard what we were, was a couple of them. One of them, the landlord was fine, but their tenant next door was scared, so they weren't going to deal with having that. So they asked us not to look any closer.
Right.
You know, things like that. And then one of our board members remembered that this location that we're currently in, 531 South Main, run by the Masons, was open for rent too. We didn't think we could afford it right on Main Street. We thought it'd be way too expensive based on other prices, but they gave us a very good deal because we kind of match with their mission.
Right, sure.
So they get a good deal, we get a good deal. And that's how we ended up where we're at.
And it is a great location. Talk to people in recovery. And it's kind of amazing, people who, you know, are new to recovery, I point them down this way for, you know, resources, work resources. You know, a lot of them are coming out of the jail or the prison system and still to this day don't realize necessarily what we're here to do. Because of the industry that grew up around recovery, a lot of people think it's a, you know, sort of a pay-to-play type place. And when you tell them, no, all this stuff is free, they're kind of shocked. And yep. Then they'll take advantage of it. And that's the message, you know, we've been trying to get out with this radio program over the last 5 years, is that it's free. Come on down. Take advantage of the programs that are here. And, you know, how we can hook you up with, you know, everything from, you know, clothing to, you know, emergency food supplies, emergency housing. I mean, we have connections yep. To, you know, get all that done.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned NIMBY, too, because we almost had a reverse NIMBY also, in that members of the recovery community also did not want us located in such a visible downtown location.
Right.
Not a lot of them, but a vocal minority.
Right.
Like, nobody will ever come in because they won't want to be seen coming in.
Right.
And to which I would quickly point out to them, well, that's why we have a back door, too.
Right. Off the alley.
So
perfect.
We've got the back door. AA we've got meetings. The front door. And I would also point to them that at that point, once one went to enter our building, we had, pardon my laughter, Wackadoo's Hair Salon
right.
was right next to the recovery center. And you entered through the same front door for either one. So the only right. people that knew you were coming in, what you were doing, was you.
Right.
And from day one, also to combat that, I would always make it a point to, whenever I had meetings, I would try and do them here. So you never knew who was coming in. It might be the mayor. It might be the chief of police.
Right.
It might be the guy that got busted on Friday night and the cops told him he should check us out.
Right.
You
right.
couldn't tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
You certainly can't tell by looking at him.
No. No, what, yeah. I always recall a meeting I had with one of my personal physicians, and I offered to, you know, get them information about recovery because, you know, in medical school, they spend a day on it.
Yep.
Or at least they used to. And my physician said to me, well, we, you know, this clinic doesn't, you know, we don't like to work with those people. And I broke out laughing, and she, you know, looked at me with, you know, why are you laughing? And I'm like, oh, you have no idea.
Yeah.
I said, today in this clinic, you are going to meet with four people that could use recovery services. And she was like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, buy me a cup of coffee sometime and I'll explain it to you clearly. So, yeah. And, you know, about the, you know, the reverse NIMBY, I understand that because, coming from the AA point of view and the concept of anonymity, it could be worrisome for some people. However, the reality is, or at least it was in my case, everyone knew I was a drunk. I thought I was hiding it from everybody, but everyone knew,
yep.
Especially the employers that fired me, the family members that worried constantly. I mean, everybody I came in contact with knew. So I can understand that. However, yeah, it's kind of a non-issue. And yeah, there were covers, you know, there was wackadoos. I'm going, you know, could go in to get a haircut.
Yep.
Except me, I'm bald, and you know that dog wouldn't hunt.
So literally, you could go in and get a haircut.
A haircut. That's right. Not like you guys who get a volume discount.
Oh, I assure you, I don't get a volume discount. For the radio listeners, you should know that I'm getting shiny.
And beautiful. Shiny is beautiful.
Shiny and beautiful. A few years ago, I was talking to the guy that cuts my hair, and he'd been cutting my hair for almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and his price had gone up. And I said, "Bud, why am I paying you more now when I got so much less hair?" Which I'm sure he's heard a lot. You know, I thought I was funny, but he didn't. And he looked at me and said, "Well, it's because I have less room for error now. You should actually be paying me a lot more."
Good answer. We're going to jump forward from the start, and because we've been talking about what's been happening, you know, kind of on a week-to-week basis here, but we're expanded in the sense that we now manage for North Idaho District 2 Health, the crisis, Rural Crisis Center Network. That's become, you know, a part of one of the many hats that we're wearing down here. But there's been a whole lot going on besides that since, you know, we last had a chance to chat sometime last year. There's Oxford House. There are other programs going on here. Renewed effort at Vandal Recovery.
Jail reentry
program. Veterans program is under new management and getting kicked off. So why don't you tell us a little bit about all these wonderful things that are going on?
Well, the secret here has really been partnering. We partner with different agencies and different organizations in order to bring things here rather than just starting them up ourselves and trying to run them.
Right.
For like harm reduction, for instance, that's not run through us. It's run here. We partner with the North Idaho AIDS Coalition on that, and they provide us with the harm reduction materials. They come down and do the HIV and Hep C testing once or twice a month. But it's not us owning that. It's not us writing the grants or the proposals for it. Instead, we just partnered with them and said, "Hey, how would you like to cover this area in addition to Coeur d'Alene?" And they said, "You bet." And I use that example on purpose because that's pretty much what we've done to expand into the other areas you just talked about.
Right.
We've been working on veterans for years now. We've had people with veteran experience. First it was Amber, and now it's James.
Mm-hmm.
And just been trying to reach out to that population because it's such an obvious population
reach
out to. There is higher incidence of mental health and addiction issues with veterans. So it just made sense to us.
Right.
And when we're able to hire James and let Amber focus more on the overall program rather than veterans, that was just a no-brainer.
Right, right.
So that came about as part of our funding that we wrote a grant for with Idaho Department of Health and Welfare with their, I think they called it at the time, IROC, Idaho Response to the Opioid Crisis Funding.
Right.
Which is now the state opioid response funding, but it's the same thing, just a different name.
Right.
So that's how we fund that. And that's why we were able to start that a few years ago. In the last year, though, we were contacted by the county, and we've really partnered with the county on a couple of things, big things. Number one, we were contacted by the county grant writer, just about a year ago, a little longer. And there was a proposal out there from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare again, probably that same bucket of funds, the state opioid response funds. And they wanted to see proposals statewide. They were going to fund a few for jail and prison reentry programs. So once the county contacted us and their grant writer was willing to write the grant, it seemed like that was maybe a pretty good idea. When I had initially looked at that, I had thought to myself, that looks like a lot of work, and I'm not that talented of a grant writer. So I was going to wait a year, let somebody else kind of plow that field and figure out how it works, and then I could copy them a year later when the proposal I figured would come around again or something similar.
Right.
But in this case, since the county contacted me and they were interested, that made a huge difference because they've got experienced grant writers. That showed me immediately that we would have a level of community support that I wasn't going to have to get out there and gin up. It was already there.
Right.
So we started that program. And what that program is, it's got a lot of different aspects to it that I'm sure I'll forget, but we have a case manager that goes into the prison, the jail, the Latah County right. Jail, a few months in advance of somebody being released. So if we determine somebody's going to be released in about 3 months or less, they are potentially eligible for the program if they're dealing with an addiction or mental health issue. And as part of that, the case manager goes in and helps familiarize them with the different resources that are available and also gets them set up with our recovery coaches, which also go in at that same time frame. And then as they transition out of the jail and back into real regular life, the idea is that we're able to provide them with support so that they don't go back to their original, not very supportive support networks. And we have a small amount of funding to help them with housing or with buying clothes for a job interview, writing a resume, transportation, things like that.
Right.
So being a part of that program while they're in the jail gets them access to those funding dollars and to more recovery coaching and case management as they get out of the jail for the first few months.
Right. Now, it's something I spoke with Sean about a little while back. When the guys get booted out of the county jail, basically they're shown the back door at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And right after breakfast, and it's like, here's your stuff, good luck.
Yep.
And
they don't necessarily have a job,
right,
a place to live.
If there's not a family member or somebody right. there to greet them and pick them up and take them, they would be left to wander around to if yep. they were in our program till 10 o'clock in the morning when somebody yep. comes in, turns the lights on, starts the coffee.
Yep.
But now we have put into place facility to meet them at the door and say, okay, come on, let's go get your program started.
And that's at the county jail level where presumably right. they're still within the community where they were originally offended and put into jail from.
Right.
Or at least close. Latah right. County's not that big.
Right.
Think of a... We're not touching Idaho Department of Corrections, but there are other programs that the Department of Corrections does that are similar. Think of that at the statewide level, wherein somebody may have offended here in Moscow. They go off to the Department of Corrections wherever,
right?
And then they don't get brought back to Moscow automatically. They might get dropped off in Idaho Falls.
Right.
So truly, they're completely outside of their support networks.
Yeah. So that's
so. What are the odds they're going to reoffend? Because they have to, because they need to feed themselves.
Right, right. I know of a case right here in town where the guy got out, had no money, no support group, and within a couple hours of getting out, was rearrested for shoplifting food.
Yeah.
Because he was hungry. I mean, and it's like that's.
So this program certainly That's doesn't preventable. Fund all that. We're not buying right. food or anything.
No, but
it helps.
Well, and if you
it,
have...
It also gets them introduced to the different resources. So it's not just you're out of jail. Instead, it's, here's the things you're working on. Well, here's the resources that are in town
right.
that can help you with that. Here's right. the recovery center. Here's community action. Here's the food bank.
Right.
So it's not just away with you. Instead, it's let's help you get settled.
Right, right. And that pre-planning, I'm a big believer in nothing ever happens worthwhile without a well-thought-through plan. So having that plan, going into jail, working with them to set that plan up.
Well, the saying, probably as well as I do, you either fail to plan or you plan to fail.
Exactly.
It's that simple. You always have a plan. It's just sometimes your plan is not to have a plan.
Yeah. let's jump into the other big deal
the other thing we partnered with the county on, and I'm sure this is what you're going to talk to because you said big deal, the Oxford House.
Yes.
So the way that happened was, I forget the time frame on this, but it was well before we started talking with them about the reentry grant that we got
right
by partnering with them. But back when President Biden was talking about the American Rescue Plan Act, the ARPA funds,
mm-hmm.
it became clear A, that money was going to be coming from the Fed down to the state, down to the community level. And I'm talking like the city of Moscow got ARPA funds, Latah County got ARPA funds. So when it became clear that it was going to start, it was going to work that way, and it also was clear that the Fed had written into there that recovery in these funds were also to be used for addiction and mental health recovery, my staff brainstormed a list of about 10 things that we thought would be really cool to get funded that would be recovery related. And I contacted the county commissioners and said, hey, ARPA funds are going to flow this way eventually. And when they do, we hope you'll think about these 10 things. And they said, well, that looks interesting. Why don't you come to an official meeting so we can officially discuss this? And so we did. We being me, at least, did. And I represented the 10 things that the staff had liked. And I don't remember what the 10 were, to tell you the truth. But I can tell you, number one, that we thought was pie in the sky and would never happen, housing. And another one on there was transportation. I don't remember everything else, but we had some big things that were going to be really expensive and hard to implement, and some really basic things, too. So they looked at that, and they took it under advisement, essentially, and I figured that would be it. Several months later, the funds started to flow this direction, and they said, well, let's talk about that transportation and that housing. Nothing came of transportation. It's just too difficult for a small shop like us to manage. Mm-hmm. They at one point had designs on a van for us, but we just couldn't figure out how to make that work.
Right.
But the housing, on the other hand, I'd become familiar with the Oxford House concept and how it works, and we could have a whole other show about that.
Right.
But long story short, if we could find a way to buy a house, we could make that program work real easily. And they were getting enough money that they were willing to help us fund half of the, ultimately ended up being about half of the house we purchased.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
City got some ARPA funds too, and they also kicked in a little bit to help us with that.
And as I understand it, the program over there at Oxford is working really well. As a matter of fact, the current president of the Oxford House is sitting across the wall from us working for Latah Recovery Center.
Yes, he is. And so the way Oxford House works, we don't have a direct hand in it. You know, it's basically a landlord-tenant relationship.
Right.
So we don't necessarily know what's going on any given day at the Oxford House. But I can tell you, I think the capacity there is 7, and it was full within 2 weeks of opening. And I think it's been pretty much completely full since then.
Right. You can go online, look up Oxford House. I could go into an explanation, but we'd be running into another hour to do that. But
there's a basically great 15-minute video online.
Yeah.
Go to oxfordhouse.org, and on the left-hand side of the screen, there's a link to click on a couple of different videos. They've got one from the 90s and one that's much more modern.
Right.
The modern one's the one I've seen a billion times by now, and it's really good about explaining how they work.
Right, and it's a great program. And speaking of great programs, a couple of weeks ago, we had a great program called the Breakfast and Dessert Fundraiser. And
such an original title.
Yes, somebody spent minutes on that.
I thought as hard as I could on different titles for that, and that's what I came up with.
It worked. It worked. And speaking of it worked, tell us about the drumroll, please, our money we raised to operate this behemoth.
It worked really well. We got about 40 table captains lined up that helped out. And all a table captain has to do is bring 8 people, including themselves, to have a free meal. And then at one point throughout the meal, they pass out a pledge card when we ask them to, and then we ask people to make a donation. The table captain collects it back up, puts it in an envelope, doesn't even necessarily know how much they raised. So that's all a table captain does. So the key is that we got so many of them, so you get 40 people each, filling a table with 8 people, and you got a good chunk of people coming. So we had about 325 people between the two events, and that day we raised $30,000.
Wow.
Over the course of the fundraiser, which I count to start at January 1, we do a mail out to past donors and contact a sponsors like Optum Idaho has been a generous sponsor of ours over the years. So you put all that together with all the other fundraising, and since January 1, we've raised $60,000.
Wow.
Towards that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's real money.
It is. You know, our I think our budget this year is somewhere around $425 or $450, which is real money.
Yeah.
But
it's more than I got on me.
By the time you figure the local fundraising that we do, and you know, this is $60,000. We got the county commissioners that give us money and some other things that we do. We raise about a quarter of that right here in Latah County. And then the other, we're able to put that up against other funding, match it and whatnot, so that that money then turns into $450,000. And it's the best money too, because, you know, when you get grants or state contracts, they never want to pay for everything.
Right.
So this is the money that goes into the cracks and fills the cracks.
Right.
You know, I was giving a presentation to the Millennium Fund a couple of weeks ago, talking about, I was asked to represent their recovery centers throughout the state for that, when they were trying to decide whether they would be in favor of giving us any money again this year. And they asked why we should support them, and I gave them a bunch of reasons. And one of them I gave was an analogy, though. They said, why should we give you, what's special about this money, I think was really the essence of the question.
Yeah, sure.
And I talked to them about how, what I just said to you guys, you know, the grants and everything don't pay for everything.
Right.
And this is really the seed money that makes it all possible. The analogy I gave them was, I said, give me a minute, if you'll bear with me, I want to give you an analogy about a rock wall I've got in my house. I've got a rock retaining wall. It's pretty wall, blonde rock, looks attractive. It's been standing for 70 years now. But all the rocks put together would not be working if I didn't have the mortar that holds them all together. And that's what this money does, because it can be used for anything I need it to be used.
Right.
Much like that mortar's holding stuff together, that means this is the money that's holding stuff together when I don't have enough funding for whatever I need to help a vet, or whatever I need to help somebody that's just come in that needs a little housing or a support group.
Right.
I can dip into this money that's called unrestricted funds.
Right.
And we can do whatever we need.
Cool. Well, you know what? I think that's pretty much got us up to date, and we are out of time. So thanks, Daryl,
for
spending a little time with us here today and getting our community caught up on what's going on. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Always happy to.
All right. And I'll close it with the usual. You know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol or other drugs,
you do.
You do.